Hello and welcome to Beyond Reproach. This is Stephanie Domingo.
And Tux Lurzel.
We be drinking and we be swearing.
We sure fucking do.
Hopefully.
Uh-huh.
We come to you from Bushwick, Brooklyn, where we record on land belonging to the Lenape Nation, a nation that is one of many still very much out there doing its thing, and we like to acknowledge that. Mm-hmm. This is the show about scandals and scandalousness in American politics and government.
It sure fucking is.
This is the last episode, y'all.
Season 3.
We did it.
It's been a time. It's been emotional. Oh. It's been real.
It's been all of the things.
Mm-hmm. Goodbye, 2020. Goodbye to the first half of 2021.
Which has been utter garbage.
Yes. It has just been 2020.
Mess. Yeah. Anyways, we're here. We're doing it.
Yes. Keep on listening through the summer because we're going to have our summer break re-release series.
We're not going nowhere.
Nope. I mean, we are, but we'll be here too.
We'll be around.
Yes, we'll be coming at you from the past.
Yes. We're like, what's that terrible movie with...
Back to the Future?
No, the Scrooge, like the... The ghost of Christmas mm-hmm. past.
A Christmas Carol.
Yes, Christmas Carol.
I'm thinking of the one with Scrooge McDuck in my head, though.
I was also thinking that, yes. That was back when we thought bad of, like, rich people. We're just like, you guys need to do better. Mm-hmm. We're going to teach you through morality tales. Mm-hmm. And now, you know.
It's funny because Dickens actually comes up a little bit in my story today.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Wow.
And rich people, yeah.
Oh, okay.
And my hatred for them.
Yes. I like that. We're on that wavelength, yes. But like we're always on that wavelength. Yes.
If growing up as a child in the 90s has taught me anything,
yes.
It's that rich people suck.
Yes, we need to eat them.
Yes, we're drop an anvil on them, an Acme brand
yes,
anvil.
Yes, an anvil.
Yes.
Wow, Looney Tunes.
Yes. Okay, so today we have cocktails, as usual.
Yes, very tropical looking ones.
Yes, my story today is from the 1980s. And I've said this repeatedly on the show before, but the 80s were not a great time for cocktails. So basically, like, learning how to make really good, balanced cocktails with fresh quality ingredients and, like, layers of flavors and different things going on. And
they weren't
like,
doing that in the 80s.
In the 80s, no, we certainly were not. This is a real skill to be able to do this. But in the 80s, we had the birth of, like, real chain restaurants getting really big and, like, dive bars really being, like, places where you would go and just, like, I mean, dive bars were around before that, but like, that, like, a woman would go into a dive bar and order a cocktail rather than just, like, a beer. Because women didn't really go to bars much before, like, the 60s and 70s. And by the 80s...
They were out there.
They were, yeah, exactly.
Okay.
The fact that you could go to a dive bar and order a cocktail or a chain restaurant and order a cocktail, these places did not have highly skilled mixologists behind the bar. They were the kind of places where you would just throw an inexperienced bartender behind the bar armed with little more than a recipe book,
yeah.
A soda gun, and a box of powdered sour mix.
I can't believe it's powdered.
It is like powdered. You just mix it with water. Yes.
Ew.
Yes.
I don't know why that's just so gross.
It's so
it's
gross.
Like it's Tang or something.
Yeah.
Like
it literally is. Ugh. It literally is. Yeah.
Do you remember Ovaltine? This has nothing to do with nothing.
I never drank Ovaltine, okay. But I know of Ovaltine.
Okay. So I drank Ovaltine because my dad is a physician. And he was out to punish us. That was our version of milk chocolate.
Oh.
And it was gross.
Like Yoo-hoo.
It was medicinal.
Do you remember Yoo-hoo?
Vaguely.
Oh, it's disgusting. It's brown, milky, but it does not taste like
There's
chocolate
There's like
milk.
Weird sediment at the bottom.
Yeah, it's disgusting. That's what I think of Ovaltine.
It is very similar. Yeah, yeah. It's very similar, but Yoo-hoo is actually better. Ovaltine, I think, has like iron and minerals.
Well, so if chocolate milk is like a well-crafted cocktail, Ovaltine is what we were drinking in the 1980s.
Oh, so you were drinking punishment.
Yes. Mm. So we had swapped these like beautiful, elegant, balanced, spirit-forward cocktails of the past for basically anything that was sweet, easy to make, easy to drink, usually super fruity, and didn't taste like alcohol at all. Mm-hmm. So when I was looking into an
This was 80s, the rise of vodka, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it started a little earlier, but like vodka was huge in the 80s.
Yeah.
When I was looking for a cocktail to do for the 80s for this episode, I was kind of going through some lists of like what cocktails were big in the 80s. And I started to notice some trends. Vodka was king. Vodka was in everything. Orange juice was queen because you didn't have to squeeze it fresh like you would lemon or lime juice. You could just buy the carton or buy that like tube in the freezer section.
Yeah, the tube. Oh my God, my mom used to love
my
those tubes.
My mom too, yeah.
Like the Welch's grape tube.
Yeah. Fruit-flavored liqueurs like melon, like Midori or peach schnapps were huge.
Oh my God, I love Midori.
Neon flavor or neon-colored liqueurs, also like Midori,
yeah.
Or like a blue curacao were huge. Any cocktails that had like bright tropical colors, things with orange juice, cranberry juice, grenadine, anything that's going to look bright in a glass were big. Tropical flavors like pineapple juice, coconut. Sour mix was huge.
Yes.
Layered cocktails were really popular. So were shots.
Yeah, I was about to say layered shots.
Yeah, we like shots really nipple. Took off the idea of a shot. Yeah, yeah.
I'm sure you're going to talk about how like everything was sexy.
That's absolutely okay. On my list. Yeah. Fancy glassware, like a hurricane glass.
It's like, I get it. Adults have sex.
Yeah, exactly. And then, yeah, last on my list was that people loved a sexual innuendo and a name for a cocktail. We had the slow, comfortable screw, the fuzzy navel, the slippery nipple. Mm. Yeah.
Men.
Oh, exactly. Very straight white boy humor. So when I was looking at all these, I was like, you know, we've done 80s cocktails before, and usually I've tried to like tweak them to make them palatable for me and you, because I know how we like to drink. Like when we did the homemade wine cooler with like fresh ingredients,
yeah,
and real wine.
Yeah, that was so good.
But this time I was like, you know what? We're going full out 80s. I'm going all in.
Yeah.
I'm going to pick the biggest cocktail of the 80s, the corniest, fruitiest, sweetest cocktail I can think of. And this cocktail has everything. This cocktail has vodka. This cocktail has orange juice. This cocktail has peach schnapps. It's easy to make, easy to drink. It's layered. It's served in a hurricane glass, and it has a sexy name. We are drinking the Sex on the Beach.
We sure are.
So shall we take a sip?
Yeah, we should cheers first.
Yes.
When I was a kid at school learning the golden rule, teacher often used to say, if you don't tell a lie, there's not a reason why you can't be like Washington someday. How could Washington be a married man and never, never tell a lie?
It tastes like peach. That's all
yeah.
I really...
Yeah, it tastes like peach.
It's sweet and peachy and fruity. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's actually a little better once you stir it.
It tastes like a watered-down peach schnapps, I guess.
It's very peachy, yeah.
Yeah, I don't really taste the
alcohol
orange.
At all.
No, well, it's vodka.
It's just sweet and fruity.
Yeah.
Mostly peach. It's definitely not my favorite, but it's fine.
Yeah, it doesn't taste alcoholic at all.
Yeah,
but
exactly.
That
yeah.
is vodka.
And
for
I actually
you.
Added extra vodka.
Who
yeah.
knew?
Yeah, I know. So this recipe calls for vodka, peach schnapps, orange juice, and cranberry juice. There are some variations.
Don't taste the cranberry.
Yeah, at all. Yeah. There are some variations out there for a Sex on the Beach. Some recipes call for, in addition to these ingredients, it calls for pineapple juice and Chambord, that like black raspberry flavored liqueur from France. I read some comments where people were like, it's not a Sex on the Beach if it doesn't have Chambord. I'm like, but nobody used that. That's like a very niche way to make a Sex on the Beach.
That sounds like cocktail Reddit.
Oh, totally. People get so weird about cocktails. I also saw some people use grenadine instead of cranberry juice.
Oh, so sweet.
Why would you do that? No. It's just red sugar water.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you're using real grenadine with pomegranate juice, but that's not what you're doing.
No.
That's not what they're doing. But the recipe that we made today is like the classic, standard 80s, like...
Classic.
Yeah. As for the history of this drink, not surprisingly, there are a few different origin stories. That's kind of the case with a lot of cocktails. And also, not surprising for a cocktail with a douchey-ass name like a Sex on the Beach, the first origin story I'm going to talk about comes from Florida.
Oh, no. God. The Ohio of the South.
Yes. I think Ohio is the Florida of the North.
No, same. I'm trying to flip the,
yes.
the script.
So legend has it that in 1987, a bartender named Ted.
I believe this story.
Yes.
This feels right.
working at a bar called Confetti's. in Florida was challenged to a peach schnapps sales contest by like a peach schnapps rep for a, you know, who can sell the most peach schnapps. So he came up with this cocktail that featured peach schnapps as a way to like find a way to sell it a lot. So he invented the Sex on the Beach specifically to appeal to spring breakers that were there in Florida. They were young, they were having sex, and they were going to the beach. And he thought, Sex on the Beach, that's the way to do it.
They didn't care about diabetes.
No, they sure did not. They were too busy exercising.
What?
In bed. Yes.
I hate you.
Yes. however, unfortunately for Mr. Ted, the recipe for the Sex on the Beach actually appeared in print in 1982, 5 years before he claims to have invented it. Yes.
Chuck's over here with his facts trying to besmirch the good name of Ted.
I know. Confetti's Ted.
Trying to sully his good name.
Yes. The more likely origin story, what happened was
thank you.
That somebody,
like, probably
yes. somebody had probably poured a fuzzy navel, which is peach schnapps and orange juice, over a Cape Codder, which is vodka and cranberry juice.
Oh.
And that may be why it's usually served layered, because it was basically just two cocktails, one over the other.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And now that is not like that set in stone that is the origin story, but that's what more people believe probably happened.
Yeah. Especially because of cocaine.
Yes. Yeah. I'm just going to mix different cocktails together and they're both fruity. I'm sure it's going to be great. Yeah. Ooh, sex, beaches. Yeah, yes. Cocaine. Totally. Let's do it. Sweet, fruity, sugar. Yes. Mm-hmm. Doesn't taste like alcohol. Let's do it.
80s.
Yeah. But either way, either origin story that you accept, if you're on Ted's team, even though he's a fucking liar. That's fine.
Tell us how you really feel.
Either way, people loved the Sex on the Beach, probably because of the stupid sexual innuendo in the name. Ugh. And when TGI Fridays added it to their cocktail menu, this drink became an 80s cult phenomenon.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Fridays did this.
Yes, they did. They sure did. And Lion Ted.
I'm glad that millennials killed Fridays.
Yes.
I think they're still around.
They definitely are still around, yes. But they're on their way out, thanks to millennials. Mm-hmm. Take another sip. It's better than I was expecting.
Yeah, I'm drinking it down. It's delicious. Because it does not taste like alcohol, so maybe
it's very sweet. It just tastes like a headache in a glass to me.
A little bit. I couldn't imagine having two of these.
Yeah, we might have to switch to something else at the break. We'll see. Okay, so let's get into it. So you guys may have guessed this already, considering I'm doing an 80s themed cocktail and this is the final episode of the season, but I am going back and I am revisiting Ronnie Reagan, Reagan. At the end of last season, I gave basically like a brief overview of just a handful of some of the big scandals that happened during the Reagan administration. Basically like a bulleted list of like, these are the things that Reagan did that were bad.
Yes.
So if you remember that, I basically was saying that like...
You said a lot of things.
Yes, I certainly said a lot of things.
Yeah.
It all kind of shaped up to the idea that Ronald Reagan was instrumental in forming the fucked up, horrible nightmare reality that we live in today.
Absolutely.
There were so many scandals and so many threads coming out of his administration that we could do an entire season. We could really do an entire podcast just about Ronald Reagan and all the things
that he's responsible for.
Yes, nefarious behavior and dastardly deeds.
All the downstream consequences of his policies.
My original plan, basically I've had this idea all season long that when we got to the final episode of the season, I was going to go back and revisit one of those stories. Mm. But as I was sitting down to write the story that I had in mind, someone sent me an article and I learned a new piece of information that completely distracted me. And before I knew it, I was writing something completely different. It's still Reagan, but it's a different story entirely.
Okay.
Even though my cocktail today is firmly planted in the 1980s, my story actually kind of straddles the 1980s and the 1950s, because I'm going to be talking about the birth of an idea within the conservative movement that helped make the Reagan presidency possible.
Oh, wow.
And help shape the political philosophy of Ronald Reagan and the powerful people who put him in office and who he surrounded himself while he was in office.
Oh, in the 50s. Okay.
Yeah. I mean, this idea was birthed in the 50s, but
I'm intrigued.
Yes. So I would like to propose a toast.
Oh, yes. Yes, yes.
To the middle class.
Ooh.
Hopefully we'll have one again someday.
About to say, who?
Yes.
Yeah, that was the time when we had one.
Yes, in the 50s. Yeah. You guys may remember from my Reagan episode last year that a few of the scandals that I talked about all kind of led to Reagan really fucking up the American middle class. So I'm wondering if you have any ideas about his motives. Like, why would he want to fuck up the middle class?
I just thought that he surrounded himself with rich people.
Yeah.
That were just in it for themselves.
Yeah.
And like, as a consequence, you know, chat upon.
Yeah. Yes.
As one might say, yes. The middle class.
Yeah. They were definitely pinky up.
Yes.
Chatting.
Totally. Yes. Yes.
Defecating.
Yes. Thank you.
Yes.
They upon were, the middle they class. They were leaving a movement.
Yes.
And not the symphony sort.
Yes. Gross. Yeah, I always kind of assume the same thing. You know, he and his administration just wanted to make it easier for the wealthy to hoard wealth and become even wealthier. Reagan was a Hollywood actor, and he talked a lot about the fact that high marginal tax rates meant that when he was a really popular actor, he felt like he could only make a couple movies a year because if he earned too much money, everything off the top would go to the government. So he didn't want to work too much and thought that that was like unfair, that he was being like penalized for working too much. So basically, I always just assumed that Ronald Reagan wanted to make the world a safer place for rich people.
If this is not true?
No.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, I always assumed that the destruction of the middle class, even if he and his people saw it coming, was an unintended consequence of personal greed. It turns out, though, that crippling the middle class may have actually been the goal the whole time.
No.
Yes.
That is dastardly.
It is dastardly, yes. So have you ever heard of a man named Russell Kirk?
No.
I didn't really know or care anything about like the history of conservative thought in America before I really got into looking into this story. But basically, most people, if you're in conservative circles, most people would tell you that William F. Buckley Jr. is usually yes. credited with creating yes. modern conservatism mm-hmm. in the 1950s. But it turns out that Russell Kirk was almost, if not just as instrumental in the creation of modern conservative thought as Buckley was.
They were in the same era, though?
Yes, in the 50s, yeah. They knew each other. They worked together a lot. They had some different ideas, and Buckley ended up becoming more popular.
Were they both intellectuals?
Yes, yeah. Okay. Yeah, Russell Kirk was a writer, a columnist, a teacher, an intellectual. He published more than 20 books, hundreds of articles, and thousands of syndicated columns throughout his career.
But he didn't have the balls to go up against James Baldwin.
No, he probably, yeah. I doubt it. Yeah.
I mean, he got his ass handed to him.
Yes, yes.
But he tried.
I doubt that Kirk did that. I think he led a quieter life, Russell Kirk.
Okay.
He's probably most famous for his 500-page history of modern-era conservative thought that he published in 1953 called The Conservative Mind. Mm-hmm. This book is essentially just one big, long essay on the origins and ideology of both British and American conservatism. And it's presented as sort of a gallery of his conservative heroes and their individual philosophies throughout what he calls modern history, but starting kind of in the mid-1700s going forward. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Russell Kirk would really not fit in with the Republican Party today. Not at all. His beliefs were nuanced and complicated and intellectual and very, very different from how most modern conservatives see the world today. But one idea that he laid out in the conservative mind really took root. So he was just as critical of consumer capitalism as he was socialism.
What?
But not for the reasons that you and I might hope or think. Russell Kirk believed in a traditional British conservative society, a society that was ruled by a rigid class system and a political landscape controlled by an elite group born into their wealth and power.
Aristocracy.
Yes, exactly. So he devoted the introduction and first chapter of The Conservative Mind to a man named Edmund Burke, who was an 18th century British conservative who defended, among other things, Britain's restrictions on who could vote and participate in politics based on their wealth and land ownership, and a British Parliamentary Act from the Elizabethan era that controlled entry into skilled labor trades and set a maximum wage on laborers that prevented upward mobility.
Whoa.
Yes. So if you've ever read a Dickens story, you will know exactly how this played out for British society and the working class
the
in England.
Houses.
Yes, exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah, everyone was Poe. If you you were either super poor or super rich, and there wasn't much in between.
Yeah.
So Edmund Burke defended and praised these policies because he believed that if the working class people made too much money, that they would challenge the social order and collapse the British form of government. And in some ways, he was kind of right. That act that controlled workers' mobility was repealed in 1813, which was great news for most British people. But within 100 years, society had changed so drastically that the aristocracy was struggling to maintain a way of life that had been stable for centuries.
Yeah, because the aristocracy, they weren't like good people. They weren't like good at what they did.
They weren't productive.
They were just lucky.
Yeah, exactly. They were born into it. Yeah.
Yeah. So they, like, having to compete with others, they're going
to
lose.
And find a way to raise money because you don't have people that have to raise money for you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. If you've ever seen Downton Abbey, you'll know that by the early 20th century, these ruling class landowners were really struggling to maintain their way of life and maintain their estates because people had autonomy now and people could leave and didn't have to.
I love when that old woman doesn't know what work is.
Yes. What is a weekend?
Oh, weekend. That's what it was. It was a weekend.
Yes. Yeah.
It's every day for you, bitch.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah. They maintained their estate because they found new forms of income, but all their friends were like selling their estates or downsizing because they couldn't maintain that way of life anymore. Literally like less than 100 years after that act was repealed.
Well, those estates were so big.
Yeah, yeah. The only reason they were sustainable was because people didn't have a choice but to make money for you. Mm-hmm. But thanks to his reverence for Edmund Burke, Russell Kirk believed that Burke-style conservative policy was crucial to stability and longevity in America and maintaining the American way of life. If you've listened to our mini-sode about marginal tax rates, we talked about how in the 1950s, the middle class was thriving in America. In fact, the American middle class in the 1950s was growing more rapidly than any middle class has ever grown in the history of the world. And the wealth and income of the American middle class in the 1950s was growing faster than that of the top 1% of income earners in this country.
Uh-oh.
But the thing is, having a thriving middle class is not a natural guaranteed result of capitalism. It's just not. After the Depression, we chose in this country to invest in the middle class, to invigorate and foster the middle class in this country by taxing extreme wealth to discourage wealth hoarding and benefit the average American citizen. We chose to benefit we the people over the rich people. And then in 1951, Russell Kirk developed this theory that if the American middle class got too wealthy, we would see an absolute collapse of our nation's social order. He believed that there would be chaos and riots and potentially even the collapse of the government because the middle class was too wealthy.
What were they going to do with their money? Buy their own private army? Like, I'm confused.
It wasn't about having too much money. It was about, well, we'll get into it.
Okay,
but
I'm
basically about having free time, essentially. We'll talk about what that means in a minute.
Okay.
He believed in the continued growth of the middle class needed to be stopped and for their own good. And these ideas were not just something that he was kind of casually laying out in his book as like, this is like an example of a practical application of Edmund Burke's philosophy. These ideas, unfortunately, I had to read a little bit of The Conservative Mind just for fact checking as I was writing the story. And these ideas are woven through the entire book and presented as foundational philosophy of modern conservative thought.
Huh.
He frequently warned about income equality
in the book,
which he called economic leveling, and the danger of letting the middle class become too wealthy and powerful. And he also warned that economic leveling could lead to political leveling, which basically meant that if the working class became wealthy enough to have free time,
okay,
that they would take an interest in politics themselves.
Oh, shit.
Yeah.
The Caucasian awakening.
I know. Russell Kirk believed, like Burke, that the wealthy were the only ones smart and powerful enough to know how to actually lead a country.
Okay. And that was an old way of thinking.
Yeah.
In the
50s, though, he's like, this is a new idea to him.
Yeah.
But he believed that the working class should be kept too busy busting their asses to ever have time to worry their empty little heads about politics.
Well, yeah. Oh, my God. That is the modern movement.
Yes.
Okay.
He said, and I quote, "Leadership by men of ability, birth, and wealth is one of the most natural and most beneficial aspects of civilized life."
Cronyism, you guys?
Yeah.
Have you tried it? It's great.
Yes. Side effects, mate.
Yes. Being crushed slowly by capitalism. Yes.
He also said in the book, "Men possess a natural right to be restrained from meddling with political authority in a fashion for which they are unqualified and which can only bring them nothing but harm." He also talked a lot in the book about his disgust for consumerism and middle class crassness. Middle class is just so gauche.
Oh.
Yes. When The Conservative Mind was first published in 1953, there were really only a handful of conservatives who actually took him seriously.
So he was born into wealth, obviously.
Oh, clearly.
I mean,
yeah.
Duh.
Yeah.
Okay.
Most Republicans didn't really pay him any attention at this point. But that didn't stop him and some of his followers from trying to promote this idea that if the middle class got too rich, there would be dire consequences. He believed, and they believed, and they were saying that young people were going to stop respecting their elders. Women were going to stop respecting and depending on their husbands. And minorities would start making outrageous demands for equal standing in society. And the country would just be torn to shreds over this.
Okay.
And like I said, though, no one was really buying this shit in the 50s. No one was smelling what he was stepping in.
Yeah.
In fact, in a letter to his brother in 1954, President Eisenhower brought up people like Russell Kirk and his rich buddies and said, quote, "Their numbers are negligible and they are stupid."
Searching for the lie and finding none.
But then in the 1960s, some of his predictions started to come true. Birth control was legalized and became very popular. And then we had the women's lib movement. And some women really did stop respecting and depending on men in the way that they had before. They were suddenly demanding equality, both in the workplace and
in
politics.
It was like they thought they were people.
I know. Ugh, how dare they?
Yeah.
They need to be stopped.
They thought they were people and not property.
Well, it's only because they had money all of a sudden. They were making their own money and they shouldn't be allowed to. And then, thanks largely to the Vietnam War, young people on college campuses across the country started this entire nationwide protest movement. And many conservatives saw this as open revolt against the government and believed that they were witnessing yet another one of Russell Kirk's predictions come true. Young people stop respecting their elders. You know, they thought they knew better. And of course, we also had the civil rights movement. There were nationwide protests and marches and riots, and some conservatives had decided that this was only happening because Black Americans were becoming too upwardly mobile and no longer knew their place in civilized society. Mm-hmm. Yes, exactly. Uppity. Exactly.
Yes.
So suddenly in the 60s, some conservatives and Republicans who had previously ignored or even made fun of Russell Kirk in the 50s started paying attention to what he had to say. And so many of his predictions were coming true that some people even saw him as like a prophet for the modern era.
He's an oracle.
Yeah. Unfortunately for these people, the economy was still doing really well in the 60s. The middle class was still strong, healthy, and relatively comfortable despite all the sort of civil unrest and protests that were going on.
It's so weird that people really thought things could stay the same.
For, like, literally, the 50s were a weird time. Like, I've talked a lot about McCarthyism.
Change is constant.
Yeah.
In every era, but they're just like, we need to keep things as they are. It's like, yeah. But no. How?
Exactly. That's we live in a time when technology ever. Is changing. It's yeah. not going to happen. It's just going to change faster and faster and faster as we move forward.
Yes.
But in the 50s, McCarthyism was really kind of like a idea that everyone had to be the same, like the keeping up with the Joneses. You wanted every man wore a gray flannel suit and a hat. That's everyone looked the same.
Yeah.
Everyone's houses looked the same.
Yeah.
You had a white picket fence.
That's two when and a half everyone kids talked the same too.
Exactly.
That yeah. like mid-Atlantic
accent. Yeah. yeah. That was very much about
so weird.
You know, the
conformity.
Whole conformity. Exactly. So in the 50s,
that worked so well for the Germans.
Yeah, exactly.
Fuck off. Like, what?
We were super prosperous, but like there was no opportunity for self-expression. And then in the 60s, people just went wild.
Yeah.
And young people were like, I'm going to do whatever the fuck that I want. I'm going to do drugs. I'm going to have sex. I'm going to yeah. run around with no clothes on. And the older people in this country were like, what the fuck is going on right now? Yeah.
That sounds very familiar.
Like it was the end of the world. So that's why people were latching on to Russell Kirk. Like, this man knows how to keep things the same.
Okay.
Yeah.
Hmm.
You know, there was a lot of...
That was my Marge.
Yeah. yeah. Let me off.
Yes.
yeah.
You're on the plane.
Yeah. In the 60s, you know, there was a lot of civil unrest, but the middle class was still doing great, and everyone was kind of fine with keeping things economically
yeah.
going the way they were going.
Yeah.
But then in the 1970s, our economy started to shift towards globalization. Mm. And suddenly, American manufacturing had international competition for consumer goods. And we were not used to that.
No.
And our economy stalled out. Yeah. That's a very simplified version of what was going on with the economy in the 70s, but...
Yeah.
What happened was, for the first time since the 1930s, the growth of the middle class had flatlined, and people were suddenly unhappy with this economic model that they had been benefiting from for over 40 years.
Okay.
So at the same time in the 1970s, we suddenly started seeing all of these really wealthy conservatives and wealthy Republicans starting to build a massive infrastructure of think tanks and media outlets who would promote and amplify their messaging and ideas and help them twist public perception on what they believed the issues were in this country. And by this point, the people that were running these think tanks were big fans of Russell Kirk. They believed, just like Kirk, that the middle class was out of control and they needed to be stopped because they saw the children of the middle class running out and doing drugs and having sex unprotected. And,
being children.
Yeah. They okay. saw these uppity black people having money and trying to act like they should have
we're
a right
white.
To live a life that didn't consist of servitude to a white family. Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Exactly. Uh-oh. And they were not happy about it. So they had this idea for a solution to this problem that just happened to have the pleasant side effect
Ooh.
Of making them and their donors very rich and powerful.
I'm shocked by this.
Yes.
What a pleasant set of circumstances.
I know, yeah.
Lucky them.
I know. By the time Jimmy Carter took office in 1977, the country was already in a recession. And Carter tried to get things back on track, but these things take time. Mm-hmm. As we know, we've seen time and time again, the economy, you can't snap a finger, wave a magic wand, and things are just back on track.
Capitalism always crashes,
yeah.
and it takes a while for it to recover.
But Americans are impatient as fuck.
Yeah.
So when Reagan ran
But we're brand new. We're children.
Yes, we
we're
certainly
toddlers.
Are. Yeah. So when Reagan ran for president in 1980, he focused a lot of attention on the recession. He asked the American people, are you better off than you were 4 years ago? And most people, the answer was no. Things weren't that bad. They had no idea how bad things could be. But the fact that the recession had started before Carter even took office didn't matter.
Doesn't matter, yeah.
The think tanks...
It's like Obama.
Yeah, exactly.
You did this to us. It's like, wait, what?
Bush did this to you, but yeah. The think tanks were on Reagan's side. Reagan was great at messaging. He was charismatic. He was charming. And
he was an actor.
Professionally trained to be great on camera.
Yeah
literally.
He's good at saying words that... Yes. he was a thespian.
Yes. He was also oozing populist appeal. He promised to make America great again by lowering taxes to create jobs and by reducing the size of the federal government. And Reagan won in a landslide.
Yeah.
And then he and the think tanks quickly went to work sowing distrust in the American people for big government, high taxes, and the social safety net. In his first inaugural address, Reagan told the American people that the government was not the solution to our problems, but instead was the problem itself.
Yes.
He ridiculed the idea of public service to one's country and joked that there were no good people left in the government because if they were smart or competent, they would be working in the private sector for way more money.
How about the military, though? They're
that it blows my mind that he's saying, like, don't be a public servant.
Yeah.
But you can. Yeah, the military is left out of that because he loved the military.
Yeah. I mean,
he had a real hard on for the Cold War. The Cold War had kind of started to die down by the time he got in office. And he was like, nope.
Yeah.
We need to bring this back.
He needs to feel powerful.
Yeah.
We're winning in a war that no one else is fighting again.
Yeah, he's having a Twitter war with Gorbachev.
Ugh.
He also told the American public that the 9 most frightening words in the English language were, I'm from the government and I'm here to help. And many Americans believed that Reagan's attack on big government sounded reasonable and even beneficial on paper. But in reality, this was all just smoke and mirrors. He needed to get people to distrust the government and resent taxation so that he and his cronies could start fucking everything up from the inside and no one would object.
Yeah.
It looks like, from the outside, the singular mission of the Reagan Revolution was simply to help rich people and giant corporations get richer.
Yeah,
that's what I've always assumed.
Yeah.
But the theorists...
You really think it's to destroy the middle class?
These think tanks were driving this revolution, and they believed that by intentionally gutting the middle class, they would be helping to restore safety and stability to the United States, both politically and economically. They believed that they were not just doing this out of greed. They thought that they were doing a good and noble thing for the country. You know, they were saving the country from itself. And that by knocking the middle class down a peg, they would be able to end all these protests and stop the social instability. Mm. So the plan was to declare war on labor unions so that wages could slide back down, to end free college across the country so that these students wouldn't have so much free time to protest, and to expand on Nixon's anti-drug laws so that they could use them against the anti-war protesters and black people.
Of course.
Reagan promised the American people that across-the-board tax cuts would liberate every income class from excessive taxations. He told us that more money in private hands would stimulate an industrial boom, leading to more jobs. And he said that everyone would win, even the poor. But this was a lie from the very start.
Nice, yeah.
He cut the top tax bracket for millionaires and multimillionaires. We didn't really even have billionaires back then.
Yeah.
But multimillionaires were paying 74% of the top
tier
tax bracket.
Yeah.
He cut that to 25.
Oh my God.
Yes. Not overnight. It was a little bit gradual, but yeah.
That's why even tax them at all?
Seriously. Exactly. They're literally paying less than most people.
Yeah. How are you paying?
When he first got into office, he did give the working class a tax break because he told them he would.
Loved him after that. Like,
yeah.
All the money they got.
Exactly. Yeah.
Whoa.
So he promised that the working class was going to get a tax break too, and he did give it to them, but then immediately took it back. Over the course of 8 years, he raised taxes on the working class 11 times. And that's kind of how Trump's tax breaks worked too. He gave the rich a tax break, threw the middle class a bone too.
Or at least kept it stable.
Yeah. He did give a tax cut to the working class.
Oh, okay.
But built into that tax law,
they went up this
it was going to go back up.
Yeah.
But it didn't go up for the rich.
Oh,
it was only going up for the working class. Mm. Reagan started, this wasn't a thing before, started taxing Social Security income, unemployment income, and tipped income. Which the rich people don't care about all those shit.
No.
These are programs for the working class.
Yeah.
The
fact
also,
that we have tips at all is racist.
Yeah.
But yeah.
The whole tipped economy is fucked up. But he also ended interest deductions for credit card, car loan, and student loan debt. You used to be able to deduct that from your taxes.
What?
Before Reagan.
What? Okay, so this is how there was a middle class.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Ugh.
He literally like went down the list. What does the middle class benefit from? Get rid of it.
But they never said this out loud.
Like, oh, absolutely not. No, it was all smoke and mirrors. Look what we're doing for you.
Oh, yeah.
And people went along with it because on paper, it really did look like all this stuff was working. All the tax cuts and all the deregulation. The stock market was booming.
Not everyone's in the stock market.
But people didn't think about that in the 80s. Like now, today, we know that the stock market and the economy are two separate things.
Very separate things.
And a lot of people today don't realize. And they were in the 80s, though. People today don't know that. Trump loved to talk about the stock market and try and equate it to the economy. And people eat it up. They don't get it. That stock market means rich people are doing well. It doesn't mean that everyone is doing well. Yeah, and people don't get that shit. So the stock market was doing great. The Dow Jones Industrial Average tripled in the 1980s. Tripled. And unemployment was down. But if you look closer at those numbers, the percentage of jobs that paid wages above poverty level had actually drastically decreased. There were more jobs, less people were unemployed, but more people were working these shitty minimum wage jobs that they couldn't survive on. And that wasn't like a thing before. He literally systematically went through and literally destroyed the middle class, check by check by check by check, down the line. His war on labor caused union membership to drop from originally about a third of the American workforce to about 10%.
Wow.
Today, that number is at about 6% of the workforce is unionized.
Yeah.
His lopsided tax cuts were basically just a massive calculated redistribution of wealth. The people at the top got richer than they had ever been in their lifetimes.
What do you even do with this money?
Seriously. And 80% in the 80s, 80% of U.S. households lost some of their share of the pie of income in this country. 80% lost income.
Wow.
And everyone was like, Reagan's great. Still to this day, we think Reagan's the fucking saint.
Because he said the words.
Yeah. He was just an actor who knew how to get people to like him.
He was a propagandist.
Exactly. Yeah.
And he got them emotionally bonded to him.
Exactly.
So it didn't even matter what their reality was. I think they felt good.
Totally. Oh, he loved to, that's the
if
whole
if you can feel good when you're poor, then watch out.
He totally fed on this whole nostalgia thing for the 50s when everything was so amazing.
Yes.
It's like things you literally had to conform or be thrown to the wolves. Mm-hmm. If you were gay, if you were communist, if you were a socialist, if you were an artist, if you did anything outside the norm.
If you were black, if you were a single woman with a child, burn her.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Like, literally, if you wore a suit that wasn't gray flannel, people would be like, get rid of him.
Wearing a tan suit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I think the think tanks really had a lot to do with it, too. The creation of these think tanks and like the...
So lobbying was already a thing then.
But I don't think it was even close to
what it
is
today.
Were these
people teaching at universities? Like, what is like a think tank? What are the... Like modern think tanks, they write our policies.
Yeah, basically, it was all propaganda machines. They own the media. Okay. They're like paying,
they own newspapers.
They're paying Fox. They're like paying personalities. There a lot of them were on the radio, especially. Oh, they were on the radio talking about like you should be afraid of
brown people.
Yeah, exactly.
You should equality.
You should be afraid of high taxes.
Oh yes, yes. Wink, wink.
Yeah, from the very beginning, Reagan promised that he was going to give this country fiscal responsibility and smaller government. But in reality, over the course of 8 years, he tripled the national debt.
Yeah, Republicans don't know how to balance budgets.
No, and that started with Reagan. We used to.
Yeah, because we used to have tax revenue coming in.
Yeah, exactly.
So
he tripled the national debt, and he actually expanded the federal government, both by doubling the annual budget and increasing the number of federal employees. He promised up, down, and sideways, smaller government, and turned around and did the exact opposite. But if he told people, isn't America great right now? Rich people are rich, and isn't it wonderful? Mm-hmm. Look at fucking Dynasty on TV.
Yes.
Everything is great. Do some coke and shut up.
Yeah.
Under Reagan, the United States went from being the leading creditor in the world to being the world's most indebted nation in 8 years under Reagan.
What?
Yes.
Oh, my God.
Yes. And we are still paying interest on Reagan's debt.
No.
Like, debt has just gotten worse and worse and worse. Like, we are
at a point. It was never paid off?
It's still not paid off. It's just piling up. Like, we're billions and billions and billions of dollars in debt right now.
So when people say, like, I remember, like, in the 90s, like, Clinton was trying to balance the budget. Like, doesn't that mean that you're paying off your debt?
Balancing the budget means an annual budget. It's like net zero. The things that we're doing in that year, the money coming in and the money going out are the same.
Okay.
But that doesn't mean you're paying off the national debt. Those are two separate things.
Why aren't we talking about the debt? Because that seems like a bigger issue, right?
Because Republicans don't want to. They want to talk about the budget. Because in
who cares about the budget?
The budget means nothing.
If we're paying interest on debt?
Yeah.
From the 80s?
Yeah.
Are you fucking kidding me?
We could go to a completely balanced budget right now. And it would take us hundreds of years to pay down the billions of debt that we have. We're, like, so far underwater, we can't even see light anymore. And it all started with Reagan. This is not how the government operated before Reagan.
Is this just, like, what modern governments do?
Mm-hmm.
Or is this what just our government
I don't know.
Doing?
I'm sure. I think a lot of modern governments run this way. And it all started in the 80s. A balanced budget was, like, no longer a concern after him. And especially paying off our debt. This is when we basically the entire nation went from savings to living off of credit cards. It's impossible for me to say with absolute certainty that Reagan personally subscribed to Russell Kirk's philosophy and actually knew the motives of all of these powerful conservatives and think tanks and that he actively went along and was intentionally trying to destroy the middle class. I don't know that with 100% certainty, and I cannot say that. It would be irresponsible for me to say that. We don't know that, and we don't know whether he was just maybe a victim of the think tank's ability to change public perspective, and that he was maybe just the unwitting puppet of the people in power who got him elected and he surrounded himself by. But what we do know is that Ronald Reagan and Russell Kirk were friends. They knew each other.
Okay, never mind then.
Yes.
Okay. They knew each other and they were friends.
At the beginning of Reagan's first term, Russell Kirk was singing Reagan's praises and predicting greatness from the Ronald Reagan White House. He had spent decades hoping for a conservative leader who could finally follow in the footsteps
of Edmund Burke. He could finally whisper into someone's ear.
Like, exactly. Yeah. He said that Ronald Reagan's election in 1980 was one of the top 10 conservative events worth remembering in history. And this admiration and respect was not one-sided. Ronald Reagan and Russell Kirk wrote to each other constantly in the 80s. When Reagan was in power, in office, between 1981 and 1989, they had a correspondence together. They were constantly writing to each other. And Kirk
visited... Do we have their letters?
No, I don't think so. But Kirk visited Reagan in Washington many, many times. Kirk was even offered positions within the Reagan administration.
Really?
He turned them down because he said that he preferred the independent life of a writer. But in 1989, Reagan awarded Russell Kirk the Presidential Citizens Medal for his achievements. So that, you know, I can't say these could just be coincidence. I can't say for sure.
That's a lot of coincidence.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. This was a hard story for me to write because I don't want to be sensational. I don't want to be spinning sensational yarns that aren't actually founded in truth. Mm-hmm. But there are a lot of coincidences here.
And this is not the type of thing that you would write down like, hey, psst, let's destroy
exactly.
the middle class
exactly.
to make us rich.
Yeah.
Don't tell nobody.
Yeah, exactly. So I have said this before, and I most certainly will say it again. Ronald Reagan fucking sucked. He's literal trash. He's not the American hero that he's made out to be. He tried and succeeded in destroying the American way of life that we had before he came to power. We live in a fucking dumpster fire today, and it's all because of him. Not all because of him, but... Sir, he started it.
He
started it.
Yeah. Mom.
Yeah. In the 1950s, the largest employer in America was General Motors. And adjusted for today's dollars, they paid their employees about $50 an hour with benefits.
Yeah.
Today, thanks to Reagan's game-changing deregulation and corporate tax cuts, today America's largest employer is Walmart. And they pay about $10 an hour.
Okay.
I know. Yeah.
And
until very, very recently, even like
that is
liberal.
Really sad.
I know. And up until very recently.
And the cost of living is.
I know.
Oh, Okay. I'm going to be okay, you guys. Don't worry about
me. I'm not. I'm going to drink more.
I wish I went first.
Isn't it great we're drinking this fruity tropical cocktail, though? Good times, yeah. And so up until very recently, even like really liberal politicians thought that they had to sing Reagan's praises and parrot his messaging to get ahead. But President Biden just did his like first address to Congress at the end of April.
Oh.
His like 100-day speech. And I actually saw a couple glimmers of hope in his speech that maybe the Reagan revolution is finally coming to an end. One specific phrase that he said that when he said this, I was actually like, what? A president is saying this on fucking live TV on a speech like to the nation? He said, "My fellow Americans, trickle-down economics has never worked. It's time to grow the economy from the bottom up and the middle out." Which, like, we know this. You know this. Yeah. I know this. Our audience knows this. But, like,
it is the lived experience of most people in this country.
But to have the president of the United States actually say this out loud.
That is a change of tone. That's significant because everyone has always paid such deference to St. Reagan.
Yeah.
Like, they've knelt on their knees and, like, kissed the rings.
Yeah.
Not to be crucified in the press because it's just the norm.
Seriously.
So far to the right, but the norm.
So here's hoping this is the beginning of the end for the Reagan Revolution and the influence of Russell Kirk.
Wow.
We'll see. I guess only time will tell.
Wow, that's a lot.
Time for a break. We need a dance break.
We do. I don't even know what to say.
I know. Let's drink these cocktails and get out of here. Be right back.
Yes, BRB.
Well, hello there. Do you wish your high school history course had more drinking, more swearing, and more ladies?
Well, do we have the show for you. Her Story on the Rocks is a long-form podcast talking about good women, bad women, fictional women, and non-fictional women from all times and places.
Basically, each week we pair two women who we research with a themed signature cocktail.
You won't be sorry you listened to our latest episode.
Available everywhere you listen to podcasts.
Cheers!
And we're back with new cocktails, different cocktails. The Sex on the Beach, the more I drank it, the more I enjoyed it, but I can't do another one of those.
Yeah, I think it's because it got watered down.
Oh, that's why I liked it more. Yeah, the ice melted. Totally. Yeah. It just tastes good.
Yeah.
But it just felt like a little bit like a headache in a glass to me. I couldn't.
Yeah, another one of these would not be possible.
It's a mistake.
I think if it was maybe smaller.
Yeah.
Like if it was in like a rocks glass or something, maybe.
There's not that much liquor in it, too.
It just feels like a lot.
It is a lot. Yeah. It's a lot of sugar.
I don't drink orange juice.
Yeah,
like
exactly.
That.
Yeah.
It's just so sweet.
So we've switched to gin and tonics.
Yeah.
Our go to like easy clear liquor drink.
Yeah, we had to have a little dance break.
Yes.
We had to listen to some Groove Is in the Heart.
Mm-hmm. A little Queen Latifah, a little Delight. Yes.
That story was a lot. I'm glad that you did it because I had no clue. I feel like you destroyed me on like a deep emotional level that I was not ready for. But I'm gonna do my best.
You
everyone.
Can count on me.
Yes, I should have known. I should have known better.
I said in that last minisode, this is the season of heavy stories for
me. Yeah. Oh, my stomach is growling.
Okay. You're like, I'm gonna throw up. Yes. This story was too much.
Yeah, I feel it in my intestines. Yeah. Like that's where all of my
bowels.
That's where my emotions are.
Yes.
So I ended last season myth-busting Abraham Lincoln, myth-busting an American legend, the man who stopped being a man the minute he was shot upside the head on Good Friday, a bad Friday for him.
It was not a great Friday.
But he became so godlike.
Yes.
So, I mean, if he's concerned about his legacy, it's not a bad Friday.
Yeah.
As a bookend, I am myth-busting another president that is beloved by people all over the world. I think it's scandalous personally that he was not shot upside the head.
It's shocking.
If you're a fan of the podcast, you know this man as the president who invented racism, whose sexy tan suit signaled to our enemies that we were weak.
Yes, President Thickums.
Yes. So I'm of course talking about Barack Obama, you know, the man whose his meteoric rise and his historic election as the first black president unfortunately made way for the first white supremacist.
Yes.
Like powerfully in your face white supremacist.
Like openly, yeah.
Openly. Like he's the only president whose legacy is based on a black president. Like the
literally,
reason
yeah.
he ran was to be anti-black.
Yeah.
Trash. I was going to do like this quick bio about Obama, but everyone fucking knows
everyone
who
knows
he
who he is,
right?
Where he comes from.
And if you don't, like,
Kenya.
Go... Tim, you know what to do. Kenya. Yeah, if anyone
I mean,
doesn't...
you can prove me wrong. Show me that birth certificate.
Yes. I actually have a mug that really? Has his birth certificate
oh
on it. It was a campaign. Like, I think I had to donate like $50 and I got
wow.
this mug.
Incredible.
One side is his face and the other side is like a copy of his birth certificate.
God, I love it,
it is, I'm so sad I didn't get to.
Yeah.
Like, it is my favorite mug. And if it broke, I would throw myself in the East River.
Yeah.
Like, I'd be lost without it.
That's like my Alf mug.
Yes. So yeah, if you don't know who Barack Obama is, please go to Wiki, consult her and
if you don't know
get
who Barack
your
Obama
life,
is.
I went to his Wiki because I was starting to do like a mini bio and I read it for the first time.
Mm.
I didn't read it all because I got horribly depressed just thinking about my life and like where he was at 35 versus where I am.
Oh,
he's
shit.
Just he's more extraordinary than I even was aware of, so I had to just like tap out.
Yeah.
But he had to be.
Yeah.
As the first black president, he had to be extraordinary in every way, and I don't know who needs to hear this, but there is no privilege in black mediocrity.
Yeah.
Unless you're a SoundCloud rapper. Prove me wrong. So, yeah, go to Wiki, learn about him if you don't know. Seriously, get the program. What if I told you that Barack Obama was like not this magical Negro who got the majority of white people to vote for him? They were inspired by his like message of hope and change.
Yes.
And moving the nation.
How's all that hope and change working out for you?
What if I told you that he was not this commie, leftist, Marxist, Antifa? Which is, yeah.
What?
I know, you're shocked. Or that his administration's biggest problem was not their, like, shitty neoliberal policies, like, at all. Or that his immigration reform, air quotes around reform, didn't lead to the problems that we're having, the crimes against humanity that are happening on our southern border right now. What if I told you that he was not a peacemaker? He was an agent of destruction and death.
Imagine that.
I felt conflicted about this story because it felt like I needed to talk about him because there was a lot of myth-making already, even though he's still alive. On the left and right, they have all of these lies, these exaggerations, I should say, exaggerations about who he is as a person. But first, we have to do a little toasty.
Ooh, raise
toast.
A glass.
So, cheers to number 44, to President Obama. Cheers to making America appear great for the first time. You fucking tricked us, and we're gonna die mad about it.
Right? Yes. Clink, clink.
Yeah. I was tricked,
and
it's not okay. So the first myth is that there's this belief that he won because the majority of well-meaning white Americans were inspired by his like unifying message. Mm-hmm. That is not true. But news outlets, they push this narrative that Obama was special because he had this sort of drive. He was young. He was new. He was pushing the nation towards change. It seemed positive.
Yeah.
And, you know, we all should be able to rally behind things that are positive, right? So even though he lived in Chicago, wink, wink, Chicago, we know what type of people live in Chicago.
He's doing crime.
But he was different because he grew up on their favorite piece of stolen land. He grew up in Hawaii.
Yes.
He was raised by his mother, who was white.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of made him special and... The media was really obsessed with his background, and I think there was a way for white voters to see themselves in him.
Yeah.
And that's not a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they could kind of take part in his victory.
Yeah.
He's black, but he's not like blackety black.
Absolutely not.
Like, yeah. If he was blackety black, he wouldn't be up there.
In no way, shape, or form.
He was like from Chicago and like wearing a do-rag, like...
He's
a stereotype of what they think all black people are. He would never get this close to.
Yeah. He's Mystique from Drag Race. bitch, I am from Chicago. Do you remember
Mystique?
That? I think she's from like season two. Kind of bigger black drag queen.
Oh, yes. She's
like, I am from Chicago.
Yes. Oh, my God. When you said Mystique, I thought of the X-Men. Mystique. She sounds distinguished. Mm-hmm. So you would think that he's like not too black. He's like the right amount of black. Just a little. Yeah. He's half. You know?
Yeah.
You would be wrong because half black is too black for white America.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
If you look at the numbers, 55% of white voters chose McCain.
Yeah.
They said, no siree, Bob, and they ran.
Absolutely.
They ran to McCain. Obama, he lost every... I thought you would like that. Yes. That's a throwback to the cocktail section of our last episode. Amazing. Barack, he lost every single white demographic except for 18 to 24 year olds and white people with postgraduate degrees.
Okay. That makes sense. Yeah. I can see it.
55% was a big deal. The media was kind of swaying people to think that it was the majority.
No. Yeah.
Like this was this unifying event, like after the fact. But he won in 2008 because it was the most racially diverse electorate that we had ever had until 2020.
Yeah.
I think it was almost 1 in 4 voters were non-white.
Wow.
So no other Democratic president has even gotten close to the nomination, losing so much of the white vote.
Wow.
Losing 55%. It's never happened. It's never even been close. And he lost even more of the white vote in 2012.
Wow. Okay.
59% of people chose Mittens.
Yeah. I mean, who doesn't love a binder full of women?
Yeah, he won re-election by a solid 5 million votes because for the first time, more black voters were voting than white voters, like at a higher rate.
Yeah.
For the first time in history. Huh. So they were able to, them and, you know, the collection of the minority of white people and other people of color were the ones who put him in office the second time. So he campaigned on this message of hope and change, but white America was not interested, like, at all. But that never stopped the spin of this post-racial America.
Sure.
Well, because it was good for business, and it was, like, it was a good look.
Yeah,
but it was a lie.
Yeah.
I don't think people realize that Trump got 55% of the white vote in the same amount in 2016. Yet the
people didn't vote.
Yet the narrative, that too. But
that's
like,
actually how Reagan won, too.
Oh, really?
Reagan, he won in a landslide, but only because there was so little voter turnout.
It
was
like, how Republicans win.
Yeah.
Trash. Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. Well, that makes sense. That's why they're so concerned with voter ID laws and like preventing people from voting, because that's the only way they can keep power
by
minority rule. So the second myth that I need to bust is that Obama was this radical leftist. This myth is it's mostly found on the right, but there are like liberals who technically think they're on the left, but they're right of center, which means that they're probably dead center.
Yeah.
They're not left at all, but like they think his legacy is one that is progressive and leftist, and they're not correct.
If all it takes to be progressive is to have black skin, then he's super progressive,
right?
Or at least half progressive.
Thank you. He's half. 50%, we can round it up.
Yes.
Let's round it up to 100. So Politico broke this scandal in 2007. About this questionnaire that Obama filled out in 1996 when he was 35 years old and running for the nomination in Illinois. He was running for Senate. He filled out this, it was 12 pages, and he had all these like spicy views. He was against the death penalty. He was against any restrictions on abortions. He was against tax breaks for top tier earners.
Wow.
He was pro banning the manufacturer sale and possession of guns, not just assault rifles, guns, period. So yeah, he was.
Wow. Where was that man in 2000?
Well, he was running against a very weak challenger, and he was also still a private citizen. So he could just, that sounds like any 35-year-old black person.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
In Chicago. Like,
that was me at 35.
That's me now.
Well,
but yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not far from 35 today, but
they use this as like a, you know, el scandalo.
Yeah.
However, you know, once he hit the campaign trail and once he was in the White House, he became much more pragmatic.
Sure. Yeah.
Because he wanted to win and did not want to be shot to death. But also, he was very, very mistaken. He really thought that Republicans would want to work with him.
look at Biden. He's like prides himself on being bipartisan guy.
Let's reach across that aisle.
Name one fucking Republican that has voted for something that you've wanted to get done.
And yet they keep fucking trying.
Yeah.
I don't understand that. For Obama to feel this way, and this is probably, I probably shouldn't say this. This is like a thing that we say in community, but like, this is how you know that his mom was white.
Right. Yeah.
You can kind of, or at least for black people, we can always tell like the people who had black moms versus white moms.
Yeah. Cause you were raised to believe that like you're a member of white society.
You're special.
Too. Yeah. Yeah.
Like just do your best and they'll like give you everything that you deserve. Like, fuck no, we don't live
That's
in this
not
world.
How the world works. Yeah.
He was branded a socialist for pushing universal health care. He was weak on crime because he ended torture in certain detention centers. He reformed mandatory minimum sentencing, and he struck down Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Mm-hmm. And they're just like, he's weak. And he committed a cardinal sin of reducing defense spending for two whole years.
Can you imagine? Like,
and they didn't burn the White House down somehow.
I can't even.
He also he brought troops home, which is a big like no, don't you do that. And he also signed the Paris Climate Accord. So all these
fucking
things,
commie.
Thank you.
Yeah.
All these things were seen as red meat to conservatives, but also a source of pride to like liberals, like almost like a blinding admiration. He's just like, he's doing all of the
left
things.
He's doing the bare minimum.
Yes. Oh my God. Mess. These policies were popular.
Yeah.
And already supported by 65% to 70% of Americans before ever announced by the Obama administration. He was a centrist wonk.
Yeah.
His team polled obsessively and he never made a move until he had stats upon stats to back up every single position that he took.
Huh.
He was never a Marxist, Antifa, whatever. He just understood statistics and he hired people who were capable and were crunching the numbers.
Yeah.
And again, he had to be good, but like researching that Defense of Marriage Act, he stopped urging the Justice Department to like pursue that.
Mm-hmm.
But that was only after three different studies came up over 72% of Americans were behind it.
Wow.
So he's seen as this progressive, but it's like, this is what the country already wants.
Yeah.
He's just saying it out loud and getting credit for it. He understood statistics and just, I guess, centrist rule, but he did not understand that, you know, Republicans just weren't fucking with him.
Yeah, totally. Yeah.
Which brings me to myth number three, that Obama's biggest problem was that he was this neoliberal shill. And this is a myth that's on the left a lot. He's the worst. His policies are the worst. And that might be true. But that wasn't the biggest problem that they were up against.
I see.
I have to first define neoliberal because it's a word that I use all the time.
Same.
Definitely as a like a pejorative. Yeah. I got a definition from Vox. Vox is who I outsource my thinking to. So Vox says
they do it for you.
They do it for me. Yeah. Yes. For free. It's great. I sound smart because of Vox. Thank you. According to Vox, neoliberalism refers to a general preference for market mechanisms over state interventions, which is okay.
Yeah.
Which makes sense. However, it kind of gets a little muddy because almost everyone sometimes prefers market forces to state interventions and vice versa. So everyone from Reagan and Thatcher who were clear neoliberals, like live their lives for this way of governing, were called neoliberals. But also Warren and Bernie Sanders like had everyone.
I was going to say,
everyone.
Is there a single politician in modern history since Reagan that is not neoliberal?
But this is just a common thing that I hear on the left people saying like, oh, Obama is so fucking neoliberal. And it's like every single person in D.C. right now is a neoliberal. Yeah. Like the word is meaningless in a lot of ways because it describes everyone.
Yeah, I would say that
situationally,
like Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and AOC are probably less neoliberal.
Absolutely.
But
absolutely.
They're still. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, a word that can define people at certain times is not descriptive, but like we know what it means.
Yeah.
So Vox went on to say that neoliberalism as a concept is useful because it describes what happens when capitalism mutates from an economic system to a guiding moral philosophy, which is when, you know, shit hits the fan.
Yeah.
Obama's administration, his neoliberalism was not the biggest issue. It was just politics.
Yeah, that's just what you have to do to play the game.
Exactly. So experts agreed that his stimulus package should have been much, much bigger. Mm-hmm. They said that $1.7 trillion was needed, but his closest advisors, they declined to push Congress for anything more than $800 million.
Which, like, for government spending is literally nothing.
If you look at our military budget,
I was just going to say that's like nickels. Not even one airplane.
It's so absurd that we have to like nickel and dime. Mm-hmm. Like this is literally nickeling and diming from like 1.7 to 8 billion, 1.7 trillion to 8 billion. It's like, what does it even fucking matter?
Yeah.
You know? But there was this bitter argument between his top advisors, Christina Romer and Larry Summers. They're just like economic people. In an early memo, Christina Romer, she pushed this even bigger stimulus. She wanted $1.8 trillion. And again, it's like, what's one more percentage point on a trillion? Like, it's nothing. But she's just like, we need to go a little bit bigger to get the economy back online. However, President Obama never saw that option because Larry Summers deleted it from the final memo because he said that it was political suicide. This is what's happening. I mean, he was hired for a job and he was doing his job, but it's also bullshit.
Yeah.
Totally. It's horrible bullshit. Especially because this was pushed in 2009 when they still had control over the House and Senate.
They could have actually gotten it done if they had tried.
Well, because of the filibuster.
Oh, God.
Because of the filibuster. I mean, they could have pushed it. But in the end, they pushed the bill that was $787 billion. So even less than the lowest they thought possible.
Sure.
It was even less than that. That was the bill that they pushed through. And it only passed because three Republicans provided the filibuster-proof votes on it.
Who were these three Republicans?
I don't know their names.
Okay. Do they still have careers?
Probably not. They were probably like retiring.
Ejected, or catapulted something. Out of the Senate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who knows what happened to them? But they insisted that $30 billion be cut from that amount. Like that was their compromise. And that a shift from direct spending to tax breaks. So they probably still have their jobs because they fucked up the bill completely.
Yeah.
Garbage. So in 2011, so 2 years later, this is after the midterms of 2010 when, you know, they lost control. The administration, they proposed another stimulus of $447 billion and Congress just ignored the request. Mm-hmm. They're just like, no.
Yeah.
We weren't fucking with you before. We're not even like giving you the time of day now.
Yeah.
Like, new phone, who dis? So one of Obama's boldest campaign promises was that he was going to tackle like inequality. Mm-hmm. He was going to raise taxes on top tier earners. And he was going to imagine that he was going to,
eyebrows lifting.
Yes. Tux's eyebrows are off his face.
Yes.
They're hovering above his headphones right now. Do you remember the Buffett tax? Do you remember this?
No.
Oh, okay. So,
as in Warren or Jimmy?
As in Jimmy, obviously. No, as in Warren. This was in 2015. His budget included $1.3 trillion in tax increases on like the top tier earners combined with business.
Okay.
It was a way that they saw that they could use this money, this revenue, this extra $1.3 trillion and fund a universal pre-K. Do you remember that?
Well, yes, I do remember. Yeah.
The budget went nowhere.
Uh-huh.
They're just like,
surprise.
No, we're not. In case you haven't noticed, we're not fucking with you at all.
Yeah.
So that went nowhere. And this blockage wasn't because of neoliberal ideology. It was because Republicans just weren't playing ball at all.
Yeah, exactly.
They were just trying to destroy that administration and the legacy. The same thing happened with ACA, the Affordable Care Act. Yeah, it went from a government-funded public option to Romney Care. And it was all because, you know, Republicans, this was the bare minimum and it was the shittiest thing ever. But it did cover a lot more people, but it was not what was intended.
Yeah.
At all. Mess. Myth number four was that Obama's immigration policies weren't a catastrophic failure.
Ooh.
They absolutely were. I see so many people on social media trying to protect Obama's legacy in all like manners of, it's like, this is the hill you're going to die on. Like, there is push on the right blaming Obama's administration for the kids in cages.
Yes.
And he absolutely should be blamed because this is the downstream consequence of what he failed to do. So despite two campaigns full of promises and multiple strategies based on polling data, obviously, he put in place only incremental, temporary modifications in immigration policy that led directly to the crimes against humanity that happened on our southern border, that are continuing to happen on our southern border.
Thank you. Yeah.
Yeah, there are lots of people on the right like, oh, you guys don't care that there's kids in cages. Now, actually, we do.
Yeah.
We are just as mad. And it's never okay, actually.
Yeah, they're saying that they won't really care because it was under Trump.
No. Kids shouldn't be housed like this, like animals. No.
No one should.
Yeah. Thank you. No one should. But children especially shouldn't.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's just mind-boggling that they would think that it's okay because...
This is not a partisan issue. It's human rights.
Tell that to them.
I know.
I don't understand it.
But this is an issue that I am actually largely ignorant of why Obama is sort of to blame for this. And how his policies made this possible.
I'm going to get into why he made it possible, but he deported a lot of people. And I don't know.
I did know that.
Okay. Yeah. He deported 2.4 million people, almost as many as Clinton and George W. Bush combined.
Holy shit. I did not know that.
And they both had two administrations. Like, just think on that.
Yeah.
Almost more than them combined.
Wow.
So in spring of 2014, his administration was faced with an 80% increase in unaccompanied minors and families coming through the southern border.
Okay.
Seeking asylum. More than at any time in history by a lot. Like, I'm going to put graphs on our Instagram.
Okay.
Because, like, the line that goes up in spring 2014 is, like, it is so steep. It's, like, it is almost vertical.
What was happening that caused that?
A lot of violence was happening. A lot of just instability in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras.
Okay. I mean, these are probably all downstream consequences of our meddling in South America.
I was not going to say that, but it is true.
Yeah.
It is true, and you can trace a direct line.
Yeah, okay.
To policies, things at the CIA. I don't want to... Yeah. There is a reason why this happened, and the reason is us.
Wow, okay.
So people fleeing violence, they showed up on the Mexican border. They called it the surge. Do you remember the surge? There was all this talk about...
I remember the caravan during the Trump years.
Oh, yeah.
I don't
caravan
remember.
Was different.
Yeah.
So the numbers coming in under Trump were way lower than what is normal. He just decided that it was too much.
Mm-hmm.
One person coming over would be too much.
Yeah.
Okay. So he created a system based... Yeah. Let me just go on. I'm not going to talk about him, but here I go.
Good times.
So this surge was just a crisis waiting to happen. So as a general rule, people requesting asylum aren't prosecuted.
Should they be prosecuted for asking for asylum?
People who are fleeing persecution in their home countries, they had a separate path for immigration. They weren't prosecuted because why should they be?
Yeah.
Same was true for families.
Okay.
Trump had a zero tolerance for anyone arriving.
My eyes hurt from rolling so much.
So it's not that no family was ever detained and separated at the border under Obama's administration. It did happen in certain circumstances, but they were very rare and very specific. Like, usually if a family was arriving and they found drugs on one of the parents,
then
would they be separated and persecuted.
Yeah.
Anyone coming through under Trump was separated and persecuted.
What the fuck?
Yeah. The federal government did have a system to deal with unaccompanied minors because they're not going to put children in with just adults because that's dangerous.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it was this system that they had was very underfunded because, again, Obama squandered the chance to fund a real immigration reform.
Yeah.
So they were underfunded. They were overloaded before the surge.
Mm-hmm.
Like, the system was just... raggedy, like it instantly.
Yeah.
It got backed up. So as a result, Border Patrol, they ended up holding kids beyond the 72-hour that was legal for them to do so. Like, that was part of the process.
Okay.
When children arrived that didn't have their parents, who were unaccompanied, they would hold them for 72 hours in this, like, temporary
And then what?
Area. Then they would process them. Most of the kids who were arriving had family in the U.S.
Okay.
In this... had happened. This was a routine thing that happened,
sure.
But they weren't ready for an 80% surge in children coming through without their parents.
Okay. But so they would be essentially, in most cases, held for 72 hours, processed, and then released to whatever family.
Exactly.
Did. Okay.
Exactly. So they, because they were, there was no room and they just sort of had to make do, the military, they constructed these like temporary holding shelters.
Sure.
They were put together on a military base that was empty and they looked a lot like cages because they were cages.
Yeah.
They were holding kids in cages for 72 hours and it looked exactly like what was happening in the Trump under the Trump administration because it was the exact same thing.
Yeah. But it was also temporary.
It was temporary and it was for there were times when kids were held for more than 72 hours.
Okay.
Like days.
Okay.
Maybe a week.
Not
still
that,
not right.
Not that
right.
It's okay at all.
It's
but
not
like,
okay.
It's very different from what happened
it,
under
it's
Trump.
Not only is it not okay, it's clearly not okay. It was illegal to hold them for more than 72 hours.
Okay.
And they were doing things that were illegal under the Obama administration because they didn't have the room. It's such a bad system. I could do so many episodes just about immigration.
Sure.
It's so complex. Obama, he did not push for comprehensive immigration reform when he had the chance. And two administrations later, we still have kids waiting in cages on the southern border. We have children who may never see their families again because the Trump administration did not keep records.
Yeah.
This is not okay. Mm-hmm. And this rests solely at the feet of Barack Obama.
Yeah.
Like, he created this system. He had a chance to push something. And there are a lot of people on the left saying, like, oh, you know, he did his best. Like, you know, he had a recession. He had this. He had that. He made immigration, like, front and center in his campaign promise in 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And he did nothing.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm hearing, like, liberals in my head being like, but the Dreamers. Okay, so he saved, I think, 730,000 Dreamers that were in limbo.
Uh-huh.
But he didn't create a system, like a pathway for them to become citizens.
Yeah.
He just like gave them more time in limbo.
Ugh.
This brings me to my last myth about, I mean, again, this is not an exhaustive list at all, but Obama the peacemaker, my favorite. So he came to the White House with no military experience, no national security experience, yet he had the cojones to say that he would not only end our oil-related conflicts in Iraq and Afghanistan, but he would also tackle the issue of lobbyists with their grubby little hands all over public policy. He said that he was going to get rid of both of those things.
The chutzpah.
Thank you. I love that you can say it properly. All in the back of your throat.
Yes.
I love it.
I've been doing a lot of French lessons lately, so it translates to Yiddish.
Oh, man. So did you know that Afghanistan was also about oil?
I mean, anything in the Middle East not about fucking oil? Why are we there?
I thought it was just the opium and the poppies.
Yeah.
It's mostly about
oil.
We
can make that shit in a lab now. We don't need poppies. We don't need the real shit.
No, it's about oil. And I felt so dumb looking into this. I'm just like, obviously. So yeah, Obama had some, you know, he had the nerve. He had the noive, one might say.
Oh my God.
What?
When I was a moody alternateen.
Alternateen, I love that.
The like alternative rock channel that I listened to was called The Nerve. And they had a commercial that they called themselves The Noive all the time. Yeah,
that's funny.
95.1, 95.5 out of Rochester.
Wow.
Yeah.
I remember the radio.
I know.
In the olden days.
Yeah. My dad used to saddle up the horse and buggy.
Yes.
And we would turn into The Noive.
Yes. It had that like umbrella ear horn looking thing.
Oh.
Out of.
Oh, I loved an ear horn. We could tune it into Rochester and.
Yeah.
Whoo! Listen to Nirvana.
Big city. So yeah, Obama, I don't even know where he got the nerve, where he got the audacity, but he's like, I'm here to change things. Like, I'm going to do this shit. I have no experience, but I'm doing it.
Let's go.
I'm like, again, you have a white mother.
Mm-hmm.
This shit is crazy. So within 72 hours of being in the Oval Office, he ordered a drone strike that hit the wrong fucking target.
72 hours.
72 hours. The fastest drone strike in recent history.
What?
So I am not going to talk about this too much because I plan to do this as a scandal.
As its own scandal.
Because I did not know this. And I start, there's a lot of information about it. And it is fucked up. It is really bad. So he dropped bombs on Pakistan. He hit a family just minding their fucking business. God. Yeah. And it really set the tone for his administration. He inherited an American killing machine that was very much on the offensive after 9/11.
He had no concept of how it works.
Nope.
It was like,
nope.
Word to your moms.
Yeah.
I came to drop bombs.
Yeah.
Holy fuck.
72 hours. He had already killed children in Pakistan.
I was not aware of that.
Mm-hmm. His willingness, because again, he had no background in this shit. And the people that he had around him were just the worst people. His willingness to back the drone program because he had people in his ear completely transformed the war on terror as we know it. Over time, the attacks grew far beyond anything that the Bush administration did. Like, it wasn't even close. President Obama did not end our wars overseas. Like, did he at least get rid of, like, defense lobbyists? Obviously not.
Like,
obviously not. So, as his deputy secretary of defense, he picked a man named William J. Lynn III, who sounds like you think he sounds. Like, he sounds like the worst. He's a man who was in the public sector. He worked in the Clinton administration. He was undersecretary of defense. However, after Clinton, he got a job at Raytheon.
I was just going to say Raytheon.
Everyone's favorite defense contractor.
Jesus Christ.
However, Obama's administration made a big deal about their plans to end the revolving door of lobbyists going in and out of the public and private sector from government jobs. So they created this policy. Like, this was him as, like, president-elect. They created this big policy. There was lots of press around it. I remember this. It included a waiting period of 2 years between lobbying activities and working for the administration on the same issue.
2 years? I mean, well, I guess that's better than no years, but, like...
Yeah, but this rule was waived for Lynn.
Sake.
Once Lynn agreed to sell his holdings of Raytheon stock, he was easily confirmed by the Senate. Conflict of interest be damned. He gets to head the agency that buys weapons from his old employer, the agency that made him filthy rich for his insights in pulling the levers of power and writing bills. So within months, Lynn was already pumping the brakes on military spending cuts.
Of course, yeah.
So flash forward 5 months to December.
I hate this.
I know.
I hate this.
Well, people need to know this shit.
No, absolutely.
I didn't know this until
I
looked into it, and I was sick.
And then fucking Biden puts a Raytheon exec in the Pentagon.
I feel like you have to. I mean, I'm not saying this to defend. It's just, this is what Clinton did it. Mm-hmm. Obama did it. Like, everyone before Clinton did it. Like, it's disgusting. Oh, I hate it so much. It goes so deep. Like,
oh, Lord.
So okay. Deep. Yeah. So flash forward 5 months. We're in December now of 2009. So Obama just got into office. It's been less than a year.
Okay.
He had the audacity to accept the Nobel Peace Prize.
That's caucasity that he got from his mama.
Thank you. So in less than 12 months, so like up until December, he had authorized more drone strikes than George W. Bush did in his entire presidency. Are you okay?
You just broke me. Wait, what? That didn't even register.
Yes.
What did you
this
just say?
This is December 9th. He got into office January 20th. He had already had more drone strikes than 8 years of George W. Bush. Correct.
Oh,
okay.
That my is, God.
Yes.
Oh,
but,
my God.
But sure, just like accept the peace award. Just accept it. So the Nobel Committee, which is its own fucking scandal, did have a history of gaslighting the fuck out of American presidents. FDR got a peace prize. Did Woodrow Wilson, both while in office, both while actively killing people. It was only Jimmy Carter that got the peace prize after he stopped being the head of, you know, the most violent country in the world.
It's a miracle that Trump never got it.
Thank
like,
you.
Why not?
Why not? Why not? It's like Oprah. You get a peace prize. Seriously. And you get a peace prize. Yeah.
He wanted it. He wanted it too bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. They were like, no.
He's sick about it. Yeah. That, I mean, I could go off. It's so fucked up. And to give it to him, Obama had no fucking business accepting a peace prize. Forget this. His extraordinary efforts to strengthen international diplomacy and cooperation between people.
In what respect, Charlie?
I am going to put the whole blurb of why it might explode your brain, knowing what you know now. It's not only did my guy take his ass all the way to Oslo for this, to accept this award, he made a fucking speech. 36 minutes he talked. It's so heartbreaking. It's like, you should have said that you were busy being a hypocrite. Don't go to Oslo, and definitely don't make a speech. So he was talking about the idea of war and peace. He talked about a just war.
Okay.
He said, perhaps the most profound issue surrounding my receipt of this is the fact that I am the commander-in-chief of the military of a nation in the midst of two wars, and yet you took it. So fuck off. Thankfully, everyone with sense unanimously rose up to fucking drag the Nobel Committee. Drag them for months and months and months. They had to defend themselves.
It should be centuries.
Yeah. So they, oh God, I'm going to put this on Instagram, all of their defense. They doubled down because that's what you do when you're, you know, dead fucking wrong. You have to double down.
It's a committee of white men, old white men.
Mm-hmm. Correct. So they doubled down in defense of their clearly premature, egregious fucking error. They said, we have not given the prize for what may happen in the future. We are awarding Obama this award for what he has done in the past year.
What he has done in the past year is horrific.
Horrific. You really don't even know. But yeah, horrific. Nobel, let's play pretend. This is like, you're just making up shit and you're mad that everyone is mad at you right now. But these committee members, like, they do have a history of just like giving it to people that don't deserve this award. It's like every 50 years, someone who deserves it actually gets it.
Yeah.
Yeah. It seems like they hear one speech from an American president and their panties are off.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a high bar.
I mean, I get it. President Thickums. My panties are off. Yes.
Damn it. Same. And here I am judging the Nobel Committee. I am a hypocrite. I am what I hate. So by the end of the Obama administration, the military was actively engaged in more countries than when Obama took office. And lobbyists were still running shit and writing our laws. And this is just a sampling of my favorite myths about Obama. I do plan to return to him next season. I could do another full episode of the things that I had to cut.
Wow.
I'm looking forward to season 4 mm-hmm. with a new batch of scandals.
Scandalo.
I need to end by saying that we must break this tradition of just being tribal, loyal to any man in charge, just blindly revering a president because he's president. Like, these are men with a lot of power. And as we all know now, all men are trash.
Yeah.
Like, when you find yourself rooting for a man, just remind yourself, you don't know that hoe. You don't know him. You don't. And I think I'm thankful for Biden in that way, because I don't think many people are looking at him all googly-eyed.
I do think that a greater percentage of Democrats are willing to look at their president under a microscope.
Absolutely.
Than,
more so than the Republicans.
Yes.
They're just like, Biden ain't my daddy. It's like, no one should be your daddy but your daddy.
Yeah.
What? Yeah. Trump's your daddy? But why?
Yeah, exactly. People do need to do a better job of like actually thinking about what's going on in the world and paying attention to what our leaders are doing in our name.
These leaders, they're just people like us. They're flawed and no one is perfect.
Yeah.
I'm not to say everyone in power is doing the wrong things, but a lot of them are.
Yeah.
And we're not calling them on it because we have like some weird loyalty to them. Like,
it is very tribal.
Them.
Yeah.
You don't know that hoe.
Wow.
The end.
Thank you for doing that. I'm very much looking forward to learning more about the drone strike issue, because I knew that it was an issue.
It is so bad.
I didn't realize how bad it was. And you've only just scratched the surface.
That was just the first year. Yeah.
I can't wait.
Horrifying is not even the Yeah, it's bad.
I think it's actually kind of a fun way to wrap up the season to like, I went after the GOP god and mm-hmm. you went after the Democratic god.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. Yeah.
I like that. Yin and yang.
Yes.
We did it.
Twins.
Fraternal. You're the evil one.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Well, that was intense. I hope you guys are okay. I broke you. You yes. broke me. And I think we both broke
yes.
all the listeners.
Yeah, you're right. You're right. Together, this was a lot.
Yes. Shit. Good times.
My bad, y'all. Just think about I did Elvis.
Yes, yeah.
I can be redeemed, unlike yes. some people in this room.
If you need... I did the big cheese.
Oh, okay.
Yes. If you need something to correct your mind at this point...
Groove is in the heart.
Yes. Go back and listen to the big cheese. Go back and listen to Elvis, and then top it off with some D-Light.
You need it.
That's it for season 3.
We did it.
We went out with a bang.
Yes.
We went out with a drone strike.
Oh, why did I laugh? Oh.
Oh, man. The worst.
Yeah. Thank you for hearing my thoughts.
Okay. I guess our drinks are empty. Yeah. We needed all the liquor for this. America's history is juicy. We just add vodka and
OJ.
Peach schnapps and all the juice.
Yes.
Thank you guys so much for listening to Beyond Reproach. This has been Tux Lurzel.
Stephanie Domingo.
Thank you to Tim Clough, our editor, sound engineer, and pod father. We could not do this without you.
Impossible.
Keep tuning in this summer
yeah.
for the summer break re-release
we have
series.
New things coming.
We'll have new episodes coming back in September.
Yes.
Bye.
Bye. Beyond Reproach is proudly recorded in Bushwick, Brooklyn, on land belonging to the Lenape Nation. New episodes are released the first and third Monday of every month. Please note that we are not historians. We are just a couple of drunks who never shut up and love history. Full list of all source information can be found in the show notes on our website. Please take a moment to rate, review, and subscribe. Written reviews are especially important. If you like us, please do one of two things. Leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or send this episode to a friend, family member, or someone you think would be into it. Don't forget to follow us on social media. Make sure you follow us on Instagram because we post our cocktail recipes the Thursday before each full episode. Please drink along with us if you are not driving. We also have a shop at beyondreproachpod.com. Get your merch, brand yourselves. We are on Patreon if anyone would love to show us some love and throw us some nickels to support the production of our show.